This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Good morning, good day, good evening, good night, good noon, or whatever time and space you're listening to another episode of Liner Note Leftovers. And I know you can hear it in my voice. We're on episode 23, and holy crap, am I excited for this one. And I know I'm excited for every single one of them, but I am excited for this virtual crate dig, my friends, because we're going to be telling one of my favorite and most bizarre stories of rock and roll history. The inspiration for REM's What's the Frequency, Kenneth, involving Dan Rather being beat up by time travelers. And trust me, that's the most normal detail of that story. I've wanted to tell you this story since I started Liner Note Leftovers, and it just timed out that I could do it for this one. So I'm excited. That's why this episode's got its namesake, but we got more going on as well, too. We got the reason you don't tell Def Leppard to turn it down, because it will not only end badly for fans, it will end badly for Def Leppard, and it will end badly for the state of Oregon. And the making of classics. We got some Nirvana, we got some Motley Crue, we got that very first protest song you had on your iPod when you were 10 and angsty, or maybe that's just me. But I'm going to stop now. I'm super excited. We're going to drop that needle right away. Let's get into an episode of Liner Note Leftovers. When you're a journalist, the biggest testament that you should always strive for is that your information is accurate and correct. Anybody who calls himself a journalist and is worth their salt should know that, contrary to what anybody says about the fake media. Because if you screw up, you can not only take heat from the population, from journalism boards, but you could also be on the end of Kurt Cobain's always hilarious and often acerbic wit. And that's what happened when they headlined Reading Music Festival on August 30th, 1992. But here's how it went down. So at the time, by all accounts, Nirvana was not in a great place. There was a lot of strife in the band for a ton of reasons that we already know. But of course, this was not helped by the tabloids being in an absolute frenzy. And if you think American tabloids are bad, wait until you see British ones. So when Nirvana cancels the European tour that was going to lead up to the Reading Festival, the thing pops into overdrive. People rumor that he's in poor health. People rumor that Nirvana's broken up. People rumor that he's dead. Imagine picking up a magazine, seeing your own face on it and saying dead. That's messed up, man. According to Dave Grohl, he says they even showed up at the Reading Festival and people are like, you guys are actually here? And he's like, yeah, of course we're here. We're headlining the festival. We didn't think you were going to show up. So this puts a justifiable stick in the craw of Nirvana. So they call up one of their allies in the press, a guy whose name is Jerry Thackeray, but also goes under the name Everett True. And they're like, okay, we're going to play a prank on these guys. So when it comes time for Nirvana's headline set, they bring Kreist out on stage. They bring Dave out on stage, but Kurt's not there. Where could he be? So here comes Everett with a wheelchair. And in that wheelchair is Kurt Cobain in a hospital dress and a ratty blonde wig. And everybody on stage plays along as the straight man. Oh man, Kurt, you're gonna make it. In fact, here's what it sounded like that night. Now I want you to picture this along with Kurt Cobain being in a wheelchair, frailly getting up, just looking like warmed up death. That's the image you're gonna need here.
You're gonna make it, man. With the support of his friends and family, he's gonna make it.
Some say love, it is a real.
That's the sound of him falling down and passing out. And even the song choice is perfect here because it's The Road, which is a Bette Midler film loosely based on Janis Joplin's life to just really drive home the tragic rock star image. Seconds later, though, he jumps back up with the flair of like almost a young James Brown, and Nirvana has one of the most ripping sets that they've ever had. Any lingering doubts and worries that were created during the so-so rehearsal that the band had had the night before that made them think, hey, this might be a disaster, were gone. In fact, everybody in Nirvana, who still remains with us, says this mended houses for a very long time. A few more fun little barbs in the show, with Nirvana starting a few bars of Boston's More Than a Feeling before playing Smells Like Teen Spirit, as another F you to everybody who said they ripped Boston off on that song. Kurt and Kreist would would joke that this was the last show Nirvana was going to do before they would fire back. No, it's not. We got a new November tour, remember? Hey, you want to make a record before that? Yeah, let's make a record. They teased a few songs that would end up on In Utero. And one more jab at the press. At the end of the gig, when they're going to play All Apologies, which would be recorded soon enough, Kurt asked the audience, hey, this is dedicated to my daughter and my wife. There's been some nasty things said about her. She thinks everyone hates her. Can you just say, hey, we love you? And the audience, more than happy to oblige. So the lesson here today is, make sure you got your facts 100% right before reporting them. Otherwise, a creative wit will find a way to mess with you. But grab yourself a copy of Nirvana's Live at Reading, and you'll know that for yourself. Take a listen to this, though. Imagine being there as this song was getting its birth.
What else could I be?
No matter how you feel about Green Day, I think we all gotta admit that Green Day's American Idiot is one of the most famous pieces of rock and roll protest songs that exists in the modern era. It's right on par with a Bob Dylan, or a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, or a Dead Kennedys. But it almost didn't start that way. It almost started as nothing at all. But for that, I gotta take you all the way back to before the track was dropped on August 31st, 2004, when Green Day is working on their seventh album, which was originally not gonna be called American Idiot at all. It was going to be called Cigarettes and Valentines. It was supposed to be a follow-up to the slightly disappointingly selling Warning. And at the time, Green Day was going through some tumultuous times, which wasn't helped by the 20 demos that they'd laid down for Cigarettes and Valentine's literally being stolen out of the studio one night. Seriously, the whole album got taken and it's never been found. So Green Day's spiraling, man, what are we gonna do? We gotta start a whole new album again. I don't know if we can do it. We're already up to our necks. But fortunately, or unfortunately for some, a well-timed stab at Lynyrd Skynyrd helps birth what would be called American Idiot. According to Billy Joe Armstrong, he was driving into the studio one day, and over the radio comes this just agitating late Lynyrd Skynyrd song. Not some of the old classic stuff, which has a little bit of nuance to it. It's just, like my women hot, beer cold, fast car, American flag makes me proud, yeehaw, arena rock, country bullcrap. I don't know what song it was, but it sets the fuse off on Billy Joe Armstrong. He comes to the studio, he furiously pens down what would become American Idiot, and after taking a breath for a second, he goes to the rest of the band. He says, hey guys, is this too far? They're like, nah, we're with you. Let's lay it down. And from there, according to longtime producer Rob Carvello, any doubts that they had about Green Day not being able to jive together anymore went out the window. It starts with American Idiot, and the whole album becomes this firestorm of feelings of what it to be a young person growing up in early 2000s America. Basically, Green Day says they've never felt as good about an album since Dookie, since the first run. And it's actually Rob Carvello who goes to bat for Green Day and says to Warner Brothers, who is having their doubts about this given the time and the culture and the climate, he says, if we put this out, we're gonna sell 1 million records in the first week and 10 million by the time we're done. To which Warner Brothers' response was, okay, they finally lost their minds, but you know what? Hey, if you can make good on it, go for it. This song hits, and oh man, it becomes one of the biggest of the year. It ends up getting adapted into a one-act stage musical, and in fact, it went back into the charts once again in 2018, when a certain US president was set to visit the UK. Amazingly, American Idiot was the protest tune that everybody rallied around. And you gotta admit, when you hear the song, it gets you fired up. It feels like you could take on the world. Or at the very least, get your speedometer going in your car, because according to research, American Idiot is the one song that is most likely to make you drive faster and risk dangerous maneuvers. So maybe we'll listen to this now and we'll let you use this to get yourself revved up.
America.
You know, it's not often that a story starts with a band's bassist and main songwriter dying for a little bit and ends with their greatest album of all time, but that may be true in the case of Dr. Feelgood. Motley Crue's absolute classic dropped on September 1st, 1989. Now, at the time, from anybody who's read the Heroin Diaries or has seen The Dirt, they know after Girls, 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 Motley Crue was at its most messy, and that's saying something. So in late 87, Nikki Sixx dies of an overdose. He gets rushed to hospital, he gets hit with adrenaline, and he's bam, somehow back up and running again. But to give you an idea of how crazy this was, he walked out into the parking lot, or more accurately, staggered out according to him, and saw teenagers sitting outside crying around a candle because they thought Nikki Sixx had died. They heard on the radio that it was over. So what happens is, Motley Crue's management says, buckle down, get it together, or you're done. So everybody, the whole Motley Crue, gets together and dries out. And in an effort to continue drying out, they ship off to Vancouver, of all places, and they begin recording what would be called Dr. Feelgood. And just to keep that extra change of pace, they bring in exacting producer Bob Rock, who we've talked about before, legendary Canadian producer, who tells them, okay, you're not screwing around on my watch. This is not a place to party. This is not a place to bring girls. This is a place to work. Like, Bob was so demanding and exacting that he made Mick Mars re-record the guitar part for Shout at the Devil for 2 weeks. And then he spent another 2 weeks making sure it was perfectly synced. Vince Neil would come in and try to lay down vocals, and Bob would be like, hey, I liked how you did that one word, but the rest of the song could be scrapped. So let's say Kickstart My Heart. If Vince Neil said the word speed right, but nothing else, Bob would know, throw out the song, start again. So they're 6 months in, and it's hitting a stress. The rigor, the sobriety, everybody agita and angry. It got to the point where Bob's like, all right, I'm gonna lock you all in separate rooms, and we're gonna get this done come hell or high water. But strangely enough, in Vancouver, Motley Crue had a little bit of help staying on the true path from none other than Aerosmith, who was in the studio next to them recording the album that would become Pump. So they'd put in all the work, and then Aerosmith be like, hey guys, we got a few weeks on the wagon here. Let's go for a jog. You don't need a beer. Grab one of our Perriers. You'll feel fine. So finally, after grinding every detail to stone sharpness, Bob plays the album for them. Guys, this is your Dr. Feelgood. See what you think. And Vince Neil says, from the first time he heard the bum 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 to start off the album, he knew Dr. Feelgood was going to be a hit. It was their Led Zeppelin moment, their AC/DC moment, their Aerosmith moment. And that's right from the horse's mouth of Vince Neil. Endless hits come off Dr. Feelgood. It's well worth the effort they put in, but it was mostly for naught for the rest of the band because the 150 show Dr. Feelgood tour sends them hurtling towards burnout. Nikki Sixx even comparing it to getting stiff because it feels great for a few minutes, but after 4 hours it starts to hurt. So Motley Crue would split and then get back together, then split again, then sign a moratorium to split, then get back together and play again. It was a whole long process, but with the right man behind the boards, it really goes to show those guys at any time when they get together, they can make magic happen. Now, of course, to celebrate the anniversary of this album, we're gonna play its title track, which about its name, Dr. Feelgood. It has nothing to do with the Aretha Franklin song of the same name. It probably has nothing to do with a dentist. It more likely has something to do with a dealer, and it may have even been inspired by the nickname for Dr. Max Jacobson, who was the man who loved giving out amphetamines to Elvis, JFK, Marilyn Monroe. I could keep going. But the subtext is there, so let's give him a little bit of artistic license, and we can just listen for it. There's a fairly common school of thought in rock and roll. If it's too loud, you're too old. Any band that wants to call themselves hard rock is meant to be played at hard decibels. That's why we all agreed to get tinnitus at rock shows. Our hearing has been permanently damaged. It was worth it. So just imagine going in with that philosophy and being told there's a volume limit. Well, that happened in the case of Def Leppard on September 2nd in the year 2000, when they were gonna play the Oregon State Fair. And let me tell you how it ended with Joe Elliott and Rick Savage offering people refunds as the concert was going on. So the guys end up in Salem and they're doing sound check in what they call perfectly fine venue. Staff was cool, the facility would work, and they're running through a new track called Promises when what they can only call the sound police shows up. They take them aside and say, "Gentlemen, you can't play too loud. We hate to do it to you guys, but we got a complaint after MC Hammer played here a few years ago, so we had to pass a law limiting the volume of any artist that plays here." And they were serious. This wasn't no gag. There were four tiers. We'll give you a verbal warning when you're too loud, a written warning, a fine, and on the fourth run, we're gonna arrest your tour manager. But here's the problem. I know what you're thinking. Define too loud, because Dan, like a Motorhead concert can be like a jumbo jet going off. So what do you mean? Def Leppard hadn't even plugged in their sound system. This was just the amps they had on stage, and the guys were like, too loud. So they had two choices. Either just leave, refuse to play, which actually their collaborators Tesla had done in the same building, but they didn't want to do that because a lot of fans had traveled to Salem from far away to watch Def Leppard play. So the band turns it down to a point where it actually affected how these songs sounded. Because you can't get the proper distortion if you're playing at a reasonable volume. You gotta crank that thing up to 11 and rip the knob off to get that. So the show is just not going right. It gets to the point where, as they're playing, Def Leppard is already refunding tickets as people are bailing on the show. It's estimated that Def Leppard lost $14,000 on this show alone. And tickets were only $20 a pop, so they lost a lot. Though people there to enforce the code did say Def Leppard brought it on themselves after complaining about the sound during every song. But either way, and who blames who and whatever, Def Leppard has said they will never play Salem again unless they have a different venue offered to them. The law has changed, and they also said that anybody who cares about music as Def Leppard does should protest to change the way they limit volumes at shows. Which, if there's anything to protest, it's turning down the music at a rock show. Cause think about it, imagine a song like this. Def Leppard's Women, played super low and super quiet. Apparently it exists out there. The band gave it away as a free MP3 download, but I don't want to listen to it. I know you don't either. And it's probably for the best, because that thing is notoriously hard to find. That's why we're gonna stick to a classic here. What I'm about to tell you is one of the strangest stories in rock and roll history, and that's definitely saying something, but in its strangeness, it's maybe one of my favorites, and a favorite of REM, who used it to inspire the song What's the Frequency, Kenneth, dropped on September 5th, 1994. And yes, the song is about beating up Dan Rather, but we have to start at the beginning here. For that, we gotta go all the way back to October 4th, 1986. It's right around 11 p.m. in New York City, and Dan Rather is walking home to his Park Avenue apartment. As he just gets up to the entrance, he's approached by two men, cleanly shaved, shine shoes, full suits, who run at him, begin punching and kicking him, and yelling, "What is the frequency, Kenneth?" over and over and over again. Now Dan Rather saying, "I don't know who you guys are, you must have me mistaken." And eventually, a doorman from his building comes running out to save him, and these assailants run away. Now police searched for clues, they took statements, there was even a little bit of speculation that it was Ronald Reagan's G-men coming to break Dan Rather's legs to make sure he didn't report on Iran-Contra, which was the big breaking news of the time and probably could have meant Reagan went to jail. You know, high treason and the like. But that was never confirmed. But nobody was ever charged for beating up Dan Rather while screaming, "What's the frequency, Kenneth?" In 1994, Michael Stipe of REM gets a hold of the story and calls it "Random, media hyped, and plain bizarre, the premier unsolved American surrealist act of the 20th century." At the time, they didn't even know or have suspects as to who did this. But during the writing of the song, a North Carolina man named William Tager shoots an NBC technician during the Today Show,
because it had been, quote, monitoring him for years and beaming secret messages into his head. Now, he was convicted of murder, sentenced to 25 years, but while he was in jail, he told a psychiatrist that he was actually a time traveler from the year 2265, who was sent back in time during a prison experiment. He was being monitored with a chip in his brain from the future, and the reason he'd attack Dan Rather is because he mistook him for vice president of his future world, Kenneth Burroughs. But here's where things get really bizarre. Dan Rather even said that, yeah, William Tager was one of my assailants, but the other one hasn't been found. Though it is strange to note that William Tager's story about being a time traveler is directly lifted from short stories by a Texas author named Donald Barthelme, who had a recurring character named Kenneth, and the phrase, "What's the frequency?" was frequently repeated. But it gets crazier. Dan Rather and Donald Barthelme were the same age. Both were from Houston, Texas, and both worked as journalists in Houston, Texas. And it gets even weirder, because in these books, there's a corrupt newsman by the name of Dan Lather, who in these stories is a conceited, conniving editor who bears more than a passing resemblance to Dan Rather. So some people believe he may have inspired this attack, or he was the second man. Donald Barthelme died in 89, a few years after the incident happened, and his brother Frederick has never said anything about any connection. And to this day, the story that inspired What's the Frequency, Kenneth, is a mystery. So I'll allow you to ponder on that for a minute while we listen to the track and see if it feels a little bit more conspiratorial than it did before. What's the frequency, Kenneth? Is your entity ahead? But if I decode you, you know it all be the same. You smile, come to just for a tune. You said I was the shadow. Man, time sure flies when you're having fun. But that's the end. We're done crate digging for another week. Another Liner Note Leftovers is in the books. But holy man, was I excited to take this walk down the hallowed halls of classic rock history. A lot of modern history this time, but it's good to keep it fresh, to keep it recent, because all of this ties in to the greater legacy of classic rock. So I hope you know a little bit more than you knew before, or at least you had some fun along the way. Come back next Friday, we'll do a whole new virtual crate dig. As always, if you got something to say about the show, you want something featured here, or maybe, just maybe, you want to yak about some music, drop me a line. My email's danielmsoul@gmail.com, or, of course, you can find me at my day job, 106.1 The Goat. If you can, wherever you listen to this podcast, if there's a rating system, hit us with a rating, give us some feedback, because it sure helps the show, and it gets us bumped up in the charts so more people listen and join in our fun little listening party here. But as always, I love you for coming along once again and being here. Songs featured in this week's episode were Nirvana, All Apologies, Live at Reading 1992, Green Day's American Idiot, Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood, Def Leppard's Women, personal favorite of mine, REM, What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Though they're all kind of personal favorites to me. But, you know, you don't need to listen to me wax nostalgia. It's time to call it a day. I'll see you in the next one. And don't forget, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.